This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to learn about the Big T, the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga. From one of that giant ship's last surviving plank owners, 94-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, originally from New York. Before the break, he talked about January 21st, 1945. When his carrier was hit by not just one, but two Japanese kamikazes. He described helping some incapacitated sailors to safety, but there was nothing he could do for his best friend, Eddie Mazur, who was burned so badly that there was no chance to help him survive. Mazur was the youngest of 12 children and broke track and field records at New Kensington Vocational High School in Pennsylvania. He was strong enough to walk on his hands, and you heard Bob talk about how Eddie used to use him as a barbell. According to an online tribute posted by Eddie's nephew, Fred, Mazur was also a talented artist who could sketch pencil portraits of people. I have that tribute page complete with a photo of Edward J. Mazur linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Bob Mettauer has never had the chance to talk to any of his friends surviving relatives, but we've started the ball rolling on that and hope to have an update to share soon. Bob's memories of that day and of his late friend are still incredibly clear 73 years later.
You know, the experience of seeing Eddie, it was immediately, I knew there was nothing I could do. So I had to continue doing what I was doing to help the other people. And I still remember that. They'll never leave me.
And this was the guy that you'd spent a lot of time with, that you were probably with just the day before?
Yes, we were in the machine shop. We used to do things together. What he did was he made me cross my arms and cross my legs, and he'd pick me up and press me like I was a weight. That was the kind of a specimen he was. Wonderful young man.
So you come into that hold, that room, and you see him burnt to a crisp. You know he's already gone.
Yes. I knew it, and actually, he's listed as missing in action in this in my book.
I wonder if that's ever been corrected.
I have no way of knowing, but I knew when I saw him, I knew he wasn't missing in action. He was doomed.
And what do you do in a situation like that? I'm sure there's a lot of emotions that come over you, but you're still expected to perform a job.
Exactly, that's just exactly what it was. And there I was helping people out of the other compartment. I just continued to do that. And then, of course, pretty soon, things calmed down, and they told us to go back to our original location, which was, in my case, was a machine shop. And on the way back there, myself and Thompson, who was walking with me, we found my friend Chuck Lodge. And he was without his gas mask. It had expired, and he was having real problems. So he and I, we used my gas mask back and forth so that he could get some fresh air until we got back to the machine shop. And when we got to the machine shop, it looked like nothing had happened at all. It was amazing.
And somewhere in there, there was another job that you ended up with, a pretty gruesome task to help some other sailors who had been injured. What about the bigger picture? I mean, as this is happening, you talk about the smoke everywhere, you're seeing some of the damage to shipmates, including your best friend who's killed. Are you wondering if your ship's going to make it? If you guys might even be sunk by this attack?
No, there was never any threat of that. We weren't worried about that at all.
Even though you got hit by two kamikazes?
Right. Well, he didn't damage the hull. You know, the ship itself was intact. All they did was damage the flight deck. So the ship was intact, so there was nothing to worry about.
And maybe before we get to your job of prying these rings off of guys whose hands are burned, maybe you can explain to us where those kamikazes hit on the ship and the extent of the damage. I know you've got some photos in this book that you shared with high school kids before, but for our listeners, paint that picture of where the planes hit and the damage that occurred.
Well, at that time I had no idea. It wasn't until afterwards that I was able to go up topside and find out what happened. So I had no idea. But one of them went through the flight deck. It was forward of the island and on the starboard side. Went right through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck. and the other one hit the fire control turret on the island just above where Dixie Kiefer, our skipper, was, and injured him pretty badly, so he had to be taken off the ship.
In fact, in your book, which they produced right at the end of the war, there's a picture of the skipper of the ship, Dixie Kiefer, with a microphone in his hand in a hospital bed and people all around him. What was happening there?
Well, he was so badly injured, they were taking him off to put him on a hospital ship. And he was saying farewell to his crews and you know, keep up the good work and all of that. And there wasn't a dry eye on that ship when he left. He was such a fine man, great leader. And he became a world hero, a national hero.
Well, and you say there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. So I'm wondering, where were you while that was happening? And were you hearing this come over the PA system?
Yeah, I was down in the machine shop. I was down there when it happened. He came over the PA system, and everybody on the ship could hear him. And it was amazing because he was just a wonderful person, a wonderful leader.
Yeah, and I guess, and again, we're bouncing back and forth here a little bit, but I'm just thinking, if I'm a 20-year-old kid and I've just been through all this, the damage to the ship, knowing how many guys were killed, including my best friend, and then I hear my skipper get on the PA, knowing that he's been wounded and he's getting carried off, did what he had to say help you process the situation you were in or motivate you for what you were going to be dealing with?
Well, to be honest, we were prepared for anything anyway. And the problem was when he was replaced, it just changed the entire attitude on the ship. Everything was different. The morale was different. And the person that took his place was not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was.
Well, let's talk some more about January 21st. So you told us some of what you experienced that day, and I'm sure it felt like a pretty long day. I think they hit you around noon, is that right?
Yeah, it was early in the day, yes.
So for the next several hours, it was probably nonstop action and busyness for you?
Well, it didn't, you know, really it didn't last that long because it happened so fast, and we were able to straighten everything out and get the fires out in, I would say, probably an hour, that's all. And by that time, we were back in the machine shop.
And there's a book. You mentioned your daughter found a book where she works, the USS Ticonderoga book that has a lot of firsthand accounts from the men of the ship in there. And yours is in there, and there's something that you don't mention. But if I flip a few guys further and find Vern Rampa's account, he talks about a pretty gruesome assignment that the two of you had to carry out. What happened there?
Well, we received a phone call from sick bay about the men, some of the men that had their hands were severely burned, and the ring was still on their finger, and it was killing them, the pain. So they called us up and asked if anything we could do. So my chief, Vern Rampa, said, yeah, let's send them up. So they sent us to the machine shop. And what I had a rag full of cold water and a long-nosed pair of pliers. And I had to dig deep into the wound, the burn, and lift that ring out so that Vern Rampa could grind it and cut it in half and we could take it off. And I think we did five or six of them.
And you had to do this because if you don't do that, they're going to lose those ring fingers. But what were those guys going through? I mean, are they screaming in pain? Are they gritting their teeth? And what did that feel like for you to be sticking those pliers in there?
Well, they were men, you know. They weren't crying. They knew we were trying to do the job, and that's what we did. And you know what? It doesn't take long before you become a man when you're in the service, and that's what happens. You know, we're no longer kids; we're men.
And I know this is a little extraneous, but I'm thinking there might be some wives out there who are saying, "Well, did they save those wedding rings, or did they get rid of them?"
I have no idea what happened to them.
Wasn't a priority at that point, huh?
No, not at all.
And you mentioned that during this whole time, you still haven't seen the damage that those kamikazes inflicted. When you did, when you got topside and you saw with your own eyes the aftermath, the damage, the devastation, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, you know, I was I was amazed. But by that time, it was all over. Now there you go again, you know. You're a man, you just have to go around and do what you have to do to take care of everything and make sure everything goes back to normal, and that's what we did.
Did you do something to recognize or honor or memorialize the guys who had been killed?
Well, the people were killed. There's nothing we could do for them. So they had a ceremony, and it was nothing we could do. We had nothing that we could do for the poor dead people. And who knew how long we were going to stay out at sea? Nobody knew that. So they had a program where they buried them at sea. And they covered them up, and they just... They were in a stretcher or something like that, and they tilted the stretcher, and the poor boys went overseas into the ocean, and it was not a very pleasant thing to see.
Well, and you've already told us your best friend was one of them, but is there also part of you that where it registers, hey, that could be me that they're dropping into the water?
Well, of course, it's, you know, that could have happened to anybody. Fortunately, I was down below decks, and I didn't have any problems at all, personally. Of course, I told you the story about what we had to do.
So that's January 21st of 45, and there's still another 7 months of the war in front of you. You mentioned that kind of the atmosphere of the ship changed after the change in command. But what about your role on the ship? Did that change? Did your duties stay the same, or did you move into something else?
Well, what happened there was when we got back to, we had to be repaired, and we went back out, and we were off the coast of Japan bombing Tokyo when the atom bombs were dropped. And right after that, we toured the coast of Japan before the actual surrender. And when the Japanese surrendered, we docked in Yokohama, and I had read the book Unbroken, and in Unbroken it said that the prisoners of war that had been in the Japanese prison camps and treated like terribly, they were taking the train to Yokohama, and I actually was allowed to go in the docks of Yokohama. And while we were there, we picked up 500 who I assume were prisoners of war to take them back to the States.
And they must not have looked very good.
Well, actually, they were in the hangar deck, and I really never even saw them.
And you're talking about your planes bombing Japan in the days leading up to the surrender, and even really up to and past the surrender, probably. They're still flying sorties and bombing Japan. And that makes me wonder, you had all these pilots on your ship this whole time you're there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of planes that are taken off. How did you guys, the ship's crew, get along with those Navy flyers?
We never saw them. Now, they were in a different area. They were in a different area for the officers and the pilots, and when I was down below decks, I never saw them. Mm-hmm. But I did. I did enjoy watching. I used to go up on the island and watch the planes come in, and I saw many barrier crashes and all kinds of crazy things. And I think I told you about watching the planes take off with the planes going over my head, and that gave me the desire to try to fly an airplane.
So what'd you do with that desire?
First of all, I had my four daughters through college. And then I decided to have a couple of nickels together, and I worked for the telephone company, and they started a telephone company employees flying club. And I was involved with that, and we flew out of Long Island MacArthur, and I learned how to fly a four-seat Cessna Skyhawk, which was, the identity was November 15,000. And we used to call, when we called the tower, we'd say, that's November 15,000, and they would shorten it to 000, so it didn't take so long over the radio.
But you didn't have to take off and land from a carrier anyway.
No. As I say, I had my four girls through college before I could do this.
Well, and for your four girls to exist, you had to make it through the war, which obviously you did. And I'm just thinking, if you get kamikazed in January of 45, and I know it's two or three more months that they're repairing the ship before you guys go back out, but when you did go back out, was there that fear or concern or awareness that what happened before could happen again?
No, we knew that Japan was licked, and we did go out, and as I said before, we bombed Tokyo 11 days in a row before they dropped the atom bombs. But they lost all their experienced pilots, and the way they had a few left. And what they did was this kamikaze business, they had a good pilot, and they had a bunch of kids that could take the plane up and follow their leader. And when he got them to the task force, he told them that they knew that they had to go and fly right into one of the vessels in the task force. By that time, there was no more air battles or anything like that. They were beat.
But if you've heard other sailors who were in the Pacific during this time period, you know the enemy wasn't always the only hazard. What does Bob recall about the infamous Typhoon Cobra, also known as Halsey's Typhoon? We'll explore that when we come back. Don't forget to check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.